Well, I'm excited for several reasons. First of which is I've surpassed the moment where I no longer need an introducer to introduce me, so that's exciting. My name's Dan Kane. I think I've told you guys this multiple times. I'm a nobody. I'm no one special. I'm no one that you'll stroll through the library one day and you'll see a book written by Dan Kane. Probably not. I'm just a servant of God, just like I have that in common with almost every single person here. And that's what makes this another reason to be excited, is I get to stand here and I get to sing with you and be able to lead us in study and in some, hopefully some helpful thoughts. And I pray to God to help us as we do this. I don't really like surprises when someone is preaching to me as far as, you know, what the end will be and what's the catch line or whatever. So I'm going to let you know ahead of time that the first section of the lesson will be just, you know, maybe a typical lesson, spending a few minutes looking at a text that I believe there are some helpful things to consider. And the second half, as I've done here before, well, I want to include some details, include some information about the work in Boston that this church is a part of. And this church has is supporting, you know, financially, but also through prayers and encouragement. So I want to let you guys, give you guys a progress update and a report on what's really going on up there, and hopefully that can be helpful as you guys are continuing to pray for the work and the Lord's work up in Boston, to have a little more information, be able to bring some concerns to our God in prayer. If you wouldn't mind, if you haven't already, turn to Luke chapter 21, the scripture that was read for us just a few moments ago. Luke chapter 21, and we'll be considering just a few verses that's found in this text. We're going to go ahead and read just the first six verses once again to get this fresh in our mind. And he looked up, as Jesus, and saw the rich putting their gifts into the treasury. And he saw a poor widow putting in two small copper coins. And he said, "Truly I say to you, this poor widow put in more than all of them, for they all out of their surplus put into the offering, but she out of her poverty put in all that she had to live on." And while some were talking about the temple, that it was adorned with beautiful stones and votive gifts, he said, "As for these things which you are looking at, the days will come in which there will not be left one stone upon another, which will not be torn down." I believe this is a very visual text. I think to understand this completely and to get the total effect of what's happening here, we're challenged to visualize what kind of scene this would be. So put yourself in the shoes of these apostles. You did not grow up in Jerusalem. This is a big city compared to what you are used to. You're a Galilean boy. You're a country boy. And so, of course, you've been, you know, traveling to Jerusalem every year or several times per year, perhaps, you know, for certain feasts. But this is not at all what you're used to. And in fact, these past 3 years, where have you been? You've been spending time, with Jesus. And that means, you know, sleeping in the field, using rocks as pillows. Every once in a while, Jesus would be invited to a Pharisee's house, but then, due to Jesus' words, that wouldn't really last for very long, and so they get kicked out of town per town. And so you can imagine just the really rough life they lived, and you can imagine as they step foot into Jerusalem, into this kind of this brand new environment, this kind of fresh and you can imagine the atmosphere as everyone is traveling to Jerusalem for this great feast, and you can kind of imagine. At least for me, I grew out in the country. The first time I visited the big city of Indianapolis, and my eyes just got real big. And even some days now, I walk around. I live in downtown Boston, but I can't help it. Sometimes I see, you know, buildings that were made, I think, are really impressive. I have to get really big-eyed about it. And so that's maybe the effect that this scene would have had upon these apostles, these disciples here, as they're traveling with Jesus. And then, in this specific case, we see multiple things that they were looking at. We see that Jesus and his disciples are sitting down or are standing, and there are many things to look at here. And I want us to think about what things there were to be captured by, to be fascinated with. First of all, we had the giving of alms and the giving of people's funds to the temple. And so you can imagine that people were giving loads and loads. In fact, some people were giving great amounts. And as a kid, I always imagined this one guy with like a wheelbarrow full of gold coins, just kind of waiting his line in turn to give to God, to give to the Lord. And perhaps these Galileans, they like, I've never seen that much money in my entire life. And maybe you can imagine that how, you know, awed they would be in seeing all this money and all this service and all this sacrifice given to the temple through these funds. But as we look in verse 5, we also see they're looking at something else as well. Because at this place, this was the temple, and this was a beautiful temple, a marvelous temple with all these beautiful, costly stones made out of the most precious rock and materials that could be used for building. And you can imagine, you know, these disciples hadn't been sleeping in houses or even tents. And here they're standing at the face of this most beautiful temple, beautiful structure they've ever seen. And they're fascinated at this, so much so that Jesus is like, snap out of it, guys. There's so much to see in this text. But I want to draw our attention to, out of all those things to look at, all of those things to capture our attention, what is the thing that Jesus can't keep his eyes off of? This poor widow with 2 pennies in her hand. Can you imagine that scene? These disciples gawking at this and gawking at that. And here Jesus is quietly looking at this widow in very humble attire, I'm sure. Maybe feeling a little insecure because look at the person in front of her is giving so much more than her. The person behind her is giving so much more than her. But yet Jesus is captivated by this widow. So much so that he points to her, you know, draws the disciples' attention to her and says, forget all that. Look at this person. Focus on this. Truly I say to you, this poor widow put in more than all of these people. See that person over there? She put in so much more. For they all out of their surplus put into this offering. But she, out of her poverty, put in all that she had to live on. The truly valuable and the most beautiful and significant thing to behold and to see and to observe, everyone else didn't even catch. Typically, the point made from this text, I think it is probably the primary point in some ways, could be summed up like this. It doesn't take much of a man to be a Christian. It just takes all there is of him. The sense that amount does not mean as much to God as percentage, as devotion, I guess you could say. But I also see another point, maybe a side point from this text. And so I'm going to spend a few minutes to kind of flesh this out a little bit here. I wonder, is it possible for you and I to be captivated by things, to be distracted by things that Jesus would say, hey, dummy, stop looking at that, stop looking at that. This is the most valuable thing, and you're not even realizing it. You're not even looking at it. I often, you know, wonder and just daydream about what it would be like for Jesus to be like my tour guide for an entire day. Like if I could take him to my normal routine, I could take him, where I get breakfast, and I could take him to my studies, and I could take him through the streets of my town, and I could take him to my apartment, I could take him to a church service, I could take him to where I go for coffee. I wonder what he would say. I wonder what would be the things that he would point out and saying, opportunity, opportunity. Or the people that he would say, yeah, you know, that person's important, but this person needs you. This person needs to hear it. That I am just overlooking. That I am distracting. Do you think it's possible for you and I for that to be true? Or maybe we're just so captivated by something or some things that we're distracted by what's really important? Do you think it's possible for an entire church to do that? I think so. I think it's so easy for us to consider and be distracted by the things that really are not as significant as we would think them to be. I think there are a few different examples, and I don't have the time to go in depth with some of these stories here. But in 2 Kings chapter 6, if you're not familiar with the story, you can go and turn there. We learn that Elisha and his servant are being hunted by an enemy nation, the Arameans. And because Elisha keeps telling the king of Israel basically what the enemy's army is doing all the time. So the enemy, the king of the Arameans, is like, we need to take out Elisha. And so what he does is he secretly finds out where Elisha is. And he's in this small little town up on a hill, okay? And then what he does is he sends armies and horses and chariots and this, all these foot soldiers. And he takes these people and surrounds the city during the night. And the servant, he wakes up, and you can imagine what kind of sight that would be to wake up to. We'd like to, wake up and hear the smell of the roses, hear the birds chirping. This person woke up to hear the sound of chariots and horses and footmen sent for the single purpose of their demise. And he freaks out, and he wakes up Elisha, and he's like, and Elisha's like, "Oh, don't worry, we outnumber them." He says, "There are more with us than there are with them." And you can imagine, like, what kind of scene that would have been for the servant. I said, "Oh, Elisha, I'll humor you. I'll count 1, 2 against 1,000, 2,000. You're out of your mind." And then, of course, we know the story that Elisha prays for the servant for God to open his eyes. And when he opens his eyes, he sees this army, God's heavenly army, fiery chariots, fiery horsemen, that is sent there to protect God's faithful. But as another illustration of here, you had these two men, they saw the exact same thing. One, but they had totally different responses. Totally different. I think this can be true also, if you're familiar in Genesis 13, when Abram at that time, and Lot were traveling together, and Abram said, our herdsmen are not getting, along very well, and so how about this? How about, you choose which land you'll go to, and then I'll take the rest, all right? Or I'll take the other half, basically. So I'm going to give you first pick, which would have been a great honor, and in fact, typically the elder in the family would get the supreme choice, get the first choice, but here Abraham says, I'll let you decide. And so the story goes that Lot's, considering which place should he live, and he sees that, wow, the south country, it's full of green grass and great for crops and great for his herdsmen. So he chooses there. Now, in that account, it says the land, and so he settled near the land, the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. You see, he saw all the facts, right? But he focused on the wrong ones. And so I think that can happen to us. So I just want to take a few minutes here, just real briefly, and consider what are these distractions? What are the rich gifts or the costly stones that can distract us from seeing these truly significant, and I'll put this in quotations, poor widows giving copper coins. And you get what I mean by that. And when I first started reading the story, it really caught me and really touched me deeply, because I feel like I've always been fascinated with big things and important things and things that are just, just big, big things. And I read this and I thought, this is deserving of me changing my attitude here. And even one illustration, I was doing some researching on some different types of photography, and actually street photographers, which is a class and a classification of photography, is very similar to this. What they do is you get a street photographer a camera, and what he'll do, he'll walk in the same places that you walk every single day. But then he'll come home with a camera full of pictures of the most beautiful things that me and you walk by every day. He's able to see the significance and the beauty in the ordinary. Where me and you, because we've seen it so often, we just walk through it. That's so scary to me, to think that I could be walking through and is blindsided to so many opportunities, so many beautiful things in my life, that God is saying, "Hey, dummy, hey, come on, see it, look up, open your eyes for this." So what are some things that can distract us? First of all, I want to ask, what are these things that we need to be looking for? What are these often unnoticed things that we need to be on the lookout for? And this list can go on and on. I'm just going to give a few here and maybe get us thinking. First of all, I think we need to be looking for the often unnoticed blessings of our God. Too many times we give luck the credit for what God is doing in our life. Too many times do we simply unacknowledge these good things that happen to us. What about our daily food and our daily provisions? I think for most of us it's the habit for us to thank God before we eat. But I think we all know how easy it is to say that in a ritualistic manner and not realize that that food and that daily sustenance is something that comes from God directly, and He's taking care of us by His hand that we are able to have strength and to be fed on a daily manner. I also wonder about this. Some poor widows in our life that we need to be on the lookout. Small but significant acts of faith or growth among our brethren. That's one thing I've learned in Boston. There's not as many Christians, so I look closer at the Christians that are there, and I realize that there are so many beautiful acts of faith and growth that so many times I would have been too distracted to notice otherwise. There's a man in Boston, his name's Brian, he's a Christian, about 30 years old. He is an extreme introvert. He's a very friendly fellow, but he's very afraid of confrontation, very much, timid when it comes to anything that would, kind of jeopardize his comfort zone. I remember one time, we were all having lunch at one of the Christians' house, and we decided, well, let's go out and pass out do some door knockings, pass out some flyers around the neighborhood. And so several of the men said, yeah, let's do that. And you could kind of see Brian there with his hands on the table, trembling and sweating from his forehead. Like, Brian, you want to come? Yeah. And so he went and did it. And he told us afterwards he hated every minute of it, but he did it. You might say, well, that's small. That is huge. But we often overlook those things because we're looking for or too preoccupied or captivated by other things. That's huge. And there can be many other examples of that. Emmanuel, one of the newer Christians in Boston, we were talking about a guy that we were studying with, a non-Christian, and I was saying, apparently this guy didn't have a cell phone to reach him. And I was like, well, maybe he's poor. Maybe that's why he doesn't have a cell phone for us to reach him. And Emmanuel, who's from Ghana, Africa, he says, he has a shirt on his back. He is not poor. How spoiled have we become? And these are small things that, wow, that is a really profound and helpful act of faith and a sign of trust in God for him to say that. And the example can go on and on. What about this? Well, this might be another, small but significant thing that we need to be looking out for. Evangelistic opportunities. I think, and this is something that was mentioned in the opening prayer, that we pray for pretty often. Doors to be opened, right? For God to give us opportunities to share His Word, to preach His message, to shine a light in our community. But what kind of opportunities are we looking for? The majority of converts in Boston are people that I met sitting next to on the bus or on the train or who I met on a sidewalk. They didn't come to me with a big sign on their head saying, please teach me the gospel. Please find me a church. Please help me, I'm lost. But when I asked them about their life, they answered. That's enough of an opportunity for God to work through, don't you think? So what are some things that distract us? I don't make too much of these details here, but I think these are true and all the same. The first thing that might have distracted them from seeing this poor widow is that they saw all these other people giving big, rich gifts, right? So these big, rich acts of service, these huge sacrifices of faith, maybe could have distracted them from seeing these things. So I wonder if things like baptisms can be a distraction. You think that could be a distraction in some sense? Not that they're bad or that we at all say that that's the bad thing at all. But is it possible sometimes for us to only count the number of people who've been baptized this year and not emphasize spiritual growth and founding them in the faith and these other, like those acts of faith that we mentioned earlier? Is it possible to get consumed by that? Sometimes I work with that. So the first couple years I was in Boston, or year and a half, almost all my studies were with non-Christians. So we had a lot of conversions. Now all those people are young Christians. I can't spend the same amount of time working, you know, making new Christians when all these newer Christians need help and need support and need to know how to change their life. But if I'm so captivated by things like that, then I can be distracted from that. What about charismatic preaching? Sometimes we can get so consumed with the style and with the sound and with the entertainment of preaching or even a worship service that can distract us from the message of what's really going on. Sometimes this can happen, or we can idolize a certain position in the church, whether it be an eldership, whether it be an evangelist or a preacher, or we can idolize a certain position and think that all other positions, all other needs, all other roles are somehow less significant than that. Shame on us if we ever think that because a man does not lead songs, he is somehow a lesser member or not as significant to the work here in this church or any church. But I also think the other thing that they were distracted by were these costly and beautiful stones. These are just things of life that just catch your eyes, that are just beautiful to us. These could be things like a job or a career. I think it's possible for a job or a career to distract us from seeing the truly valuable things in life. Or our finances, or our education, or even politics sometimes perhaps, or even hobbies or sports. A few years ago I visited a family in Maine, and the church there just consists of their family. And I was talking to the dad there, which he's the preacher, the song leader, he's everything, I guess, to this church. And he told me something, and they call them Mainers up there, up in Maine. And they're a bunch of, you know, good-hearted country folk. But he says, if the devil can't get you bad, he'll at least get you busy. And I feel like that can be true with us sometimes, can't it? Where we can get so busy, caught up with these things, with these costly stones in our life, or we're distracted from what is truly significant. And so this is just one lesson that I thought I'd share with you all, but also a lesson that I think Boston has taught me. Because in some days and some months, I'm super busy, I have so much to do. Other months, my studies are down because people say no a lot. And so what I've had to do, or what I've learned, is to look at life and to look at what I'm seeing and really look for the truly valuable things that God has placed there. So with that in mind, I'd like to consider just for a moment, for the few minutes I have left here, the work, God's work in Boston. So this is something I've shared with you guys before as far as the general information about the city of Boston. For those of you who don't know, may have forgotten, the city of Boston, the greater Boston area, holds a population of about 4.5 million people. The commuting region is about 7.8 million people. So the 4.5 million, to kind of put that in perspective, that's about two-thirds of the population of the entire state of Indiana, put together in a size a little larger than the city of Indianapolis. Or basically triple the size of Indianapolis. This is a very huge population, a huge area. And until about 4 years ago, there was no church in this city. I could tell you a lot about Boston, I guess, and you might be interested about a lot of things. You know, it's a highly academic town with over 50 universities and colleges in Boston. It's a highly historical, you know, place for our country. A lot of historical things happen in Boston. But if you came to Boston, I probably wouldn't show you all the, I wouldn't be a great tour guide to be able to show you all the great historical, you know, monuments and museums. I probably wouldn't be able to show you, all of the tourist traps perhaps, but I would be able to introduce you to some amazing souls. And that's why I moved up there. Not for the other things, because that 4.5 million people is a lot of souls. And those souls need the gospel. And so I moved there, about 2.5 years ago, and since then there's been some great growth. I talked to a young Christian, his name is Peterson. Peterson's been a Christian for about a year, and he is just probably one of the biggest blessings in my life. And I was talking to him before I came to Indiana for the small trip here, and just we're exchanging our plans for the holidays and that sort of thing. And I asked him, I told him about that I'd come here. And I said, anything that you'd want to you know, share with the Christians in Indiana, and he's never been to India. He's never been to another church besides a smaller Spanish church before. And so he said, tell those Christians about the growth in Boston's church, and how Boston is growing, and how the church in Boston is growing. That's one thing that he sees as being something that he just wants everyone to know about. He's never really seen a church like this. So actually, in his mind, we've got 35 members, and in his mind, Boston's a big-time church. And so don't spoil his understanding there. But really, it has been a blessing. These are just some pictures of all the Christians and all the group in Boston. I'll go ahead and let these slide on by and make a few comments. So from about 2012, the summer of 2012, 2.5 years ago, when I arrived there, there were 11 Christians in Boston. 2.5 years later, there are 35. And so that's about a 350% increase there, which is easy to do with a smaller church, but it still, you know, sounds good to me when I say it. And so the Christians are growing, and there's so many Christians coming and joining to this place here. And in some ways, it's a challenge when we grow so fast, because at times, you know, it's chaos because we have to make sure that everyone is being accounted for, and we had to know how everyone's doing, and so it really is a challenging thing. But a lot of this growth has been through, you know, most of our members having kids for the first time, having their first and second children, you know, kids and that sort of thing, which is, you know, causes a whole new dynamic, you know, for those individuals, for those couples, and for the church. So there's a lot of adjusting going on, you know, with us and just with the group there. But I'm very thankful for the church and for them. A lot of these are converts from the community. A lot of them have moved in from other places to work with the church in Boston. Some of them are there for academic reasons, to go to college and that sort of thing. But we are truly blessed. And so I want to share and kind of give Peterson's wishes of telling you about the growth and of the church in Boston. I want to tell you about a few individuals and a few stories and a few people that I've been working with over this past year. I'll share a few things that hopefully will be encouraging. I want to tell you about Joaquim. Joaquim is originally from Brazil. He speaks Portuguese and broken English. I was driving down Jamaica Way in the suburbs of Boston, and I get this phone call, you know, on my cell phone. So I answered it, and he says, "Look out window." I said, okay. So I look out window, and on this red light, there was this guy next to me who was calling me. I have a sign in the back of my car advertising for free Bible lessons, my phone number underneath it. So he thought that sounds like a pretty good idea. And so we had a conversation at a red light, and he then told me through that conversation that he wanted to learn about God and to study the Bible with me, and gave me, of course, I had his number, my phone, and so we went all from there. We started studying. But I just want to say this real quick: when we pray that God would open a door of opportunity, sometimes those doors might be windows in our cars on a red light. So that's the one thing I learned from Joaquim. Joaquim, we started studying shortly after he called me, went to his apartment, told me his life story, kind of where he'd been, really dark past. I think 13 years old, he was incorporated with a lot of drugs and alcohol. About a year and a half ago, or about 2 years ago, he almost died from drinking himself to death. And he has a young family, and just really, you know, hit rock bottom. Until one point, the morning after he realized he should have been dead, he decided he's got to figure this thing out. And so he picked up a Bible, and he's been reading it. And so when I got there, he had been reading the Bible. I think he already, in about 3 or 4 months, he had read through Genesis, Exodus, 1st and 2nd Kings, Jeremiah, the Psalms, Matthew, and most of the New Testament epistles. And so he'd been seriously reading, and he's got down, he told me a story, and he says, "Now we must study the parables." You see, apparently he loved these parables. They're so interesting to him, but he had no idea what they were talking about. He just didn't understand. He didn't know what was going on. And so he's like, "Dan, teach me the parables." Which is exactly the intention that Jesus gave when he was teaching in parables, right? That the only those who wanted to understand, only those who saw understanding would receive it. That's Joaquim. That's why parables are in the Bible. It's one reason for that. So we started studying some more, had lots of questions. And eventually, about a month later into our studies, he decided that he wanted to become a Christian. He wanted to be forgiven of his sins. And so, as I do with any person that tells me that, we talk very seriously about repentance, about counting the cost, about what a Christian and that commitment that we make to God and what that brings. And that was followed by a few moments of silence, to which he said this: The challenge is big, but the promise is bigger. And I love the promise. I'm not sure I've ever heard sweeter words spoken. And may that be a lesson and an encouragement for me and for us, that whenever we feel like we're going through hard times because of our faith, and we think that, well, being a Christian is hard, and the challenge is great, you're right, it is. But the promise of adoption and forgiveness and a relationship with God is far greater and far bigger. And may we love that promise. So Joachim was baptized. Since then, he's in a difficult position because he wants desperately for his wife to follow in his own in these steps and follow the Lord and to be able to kind of, you know, follow his lead here. But his wife is very connected to the social element of a Baptist church nearby. So that makes it very difficult for him, because he wants desperately to for his wife not to lose faith and not to get overwhelmed and these sorts of things. And so right now he's continuing to go to the Baptist church because he's so worried about losing his wife and his little daughter, his 2-year-old daughter. And so prayers for Joachim that he would be able to have commitment to truth, and that he would uplead his family, and that he would do whatever it takes, you know, and even if he has to sing that hymn, if none go with me, I still will follow. I pray that Joachim could pray that, you know, with a full heart. I want to tell you about Rob. Rob is a very intelligent man. Let me tell you how I came into contact with Rob. Rob is getting his master's at Boston University. He's going to be a psychiatrist. And Boston University is a very, you know, prestigious college, and he's a very smart guy, very smart guy. Peterson is the person who talked to him on the bus. Now, none of you guys know Peterson, but Peterson's a kind of a little bit of an awkward fellow. You know, he's not the most, you know, brightest. He's probably not the easiest person to talk to. He doesn't really understand things super well. But somehow, God used Peterson to talk to Rob and persuaded Rob to have a Bible study. God can do great things through little people. You know, people who, you know, maybe you ever feel that way, well, I'm just not good enough, I'm not equipped enough, I'm not smart enough. God works amazing things through people who feel very small. I mean, read the Bible. So, okay. And so Rob, we started studying together, and we're just studying, eventually he realized, and he's a very religious individual, so he was already one of the church leaders of his community church that he goes to. And he got convicted about what the purpose of baptism was, for the forgiveness of sins in order to receive the gift of the Holy Spirit. And we learned this, and we studied this for the first time with me and Peterson at a Wendy's. And he says, I need to talk to my pastor about this. And I was so worried. I was like, you know, I hate to let you go, and, you know, what will he say? What will the conversation be like? So he went with his pastor, just out of curiosity for my part, the day after he talked to his pastor, before I even heard how it went, I went to the church website where he went, and there's a brand new article about what baptism is and what baptism is not. And it was not for the forgiveness of sins. I'm like, oh no, this went really bad, I'm sure. So Rob came back to me, and he said, well, my pastor says that it's not for forgiveness of sins, and I don't need to be baptized, but he's wrong. Then what Rob did next was entirely his choice, and I again assured him that this is a personal thing between you and God. But he felt responsible, at least to his church, and to that he decided that the pastor would even allow it for him to get baptized at his church in front of his, you know, these friends, these religious friends of his. And so I wasn't there for this, but well, what are you going to do there? Because, like, they don't believe the same thing you believe. And when he got up there, and he read Acts 2, and he read Romans 6, he says, that's what I'm doing. And he was baptized into Christ. Since then, he has continued to feel very, very strongly loyal to the Christians there, or to the religious individuals there. And so his aim is to teach them about the truth and to kind of get them on board with looking at the Bible. Thus far, he's not had much success. So I kind of wonder, you know, what God can do through this, or what will be the line in the sand in which he has to kind of, reconsider his plan. But prayers for Rob and his influence with the people that he has. Let me talk about Sybil here just for a moment or two here. Sybil, we met Sybil, Justin, the other evangelist in Boston, was having a weekly Bible study at a assisted living home for elderly folk with some disabilities. And so Justin was having a study there. And so not a great study from his perspective, at least. It seems like people weren't really committed to it, and they weren't really, you know, so it's kind of a difficult study. But he kept with it. He kept with it over a couple of years. He kept with it. Until finally, this lady, who wasn't even living there, she's her mom, you know, Sybil's mom is at the assisted living center, started coming and kind of listening in and kind of, you know, investigating what this was all about. And she started becoming part of the studies. And even we started studying with her individually afterwards. And she started coming to our services and to our Bible classes and stuff. And so this is fantastic. So we finally had that conversation about her relationship with God and where that needs to go and kind of saying, hey, you know, this is the next step for you is to become a Christian, to be forgiven of your sins. And that was a very difficult choice for her because she had racked up a lot of debt throughout her life. And so she had certain individuals in her life that were helping her get out from underneath all this debt. And these individuals would be individuals who would, she felt strongly would not continue the support if she were to become a Christian. So me, in the ho-hum attitude that I have, like, well, great. This is a great opportunity for her first step as a Christian to, you know, be, you know, all out denial of self and just trusting God completely. 2 weeks later, as she is just conflicted about this situation, due to some circumstances that I don't know where to give credit to this other than to the divine, she was contacted by a debt forgiveness agency, and all of her debt went away. And then she became a Christian 2 days later. Part of me was, like, disappointed almost. Like, wait a minute, like, this is supposed to be hard. She's supposed to, like, you know, forsake everything and follow Jesus, right? And then I rethought about that, and I call what happened there, I think I call that grace, where God was opening a door. And God could have required for her to make that decision, even with all that baggage and all with that risk. But sometimes God opens a door, and God makes a bridge where there was none. And God gives us, helps us out sometimes. And in that situation, God helps Sybil out and encourages her. So I call that grace. So Sybil, just moments before she was baptized, she was talking to me and Justin. We're, you know, talking about, again, the purpose of this and commitment. And she says, I'm 50 years old, but I'm not too old for a fresh start. Amen. Let me tell you about Giovanna real quick. Giovanna is someone that, if you've been receiving my reports at all, she's been in my reports for a long time. I've known her for you know, probably a year and a half at least at this point. She kind of was coming to some of our weekly Bible studies that we have, our group studies, and you know, she was converted and was baptized into Christ several years ago. Actually, you know, kind of through some teaching that she received from some denominational you know, Christians. And so, but since then she realized the church that she was a part of wasn't following the whole counsel of God. And so was kind of wandering religiously for a few years here. And so I met her and was studying with her and I just knew that, you know, that this was someone who was really seeking the Lord. But then there were some loyalties, that she still had and some complications with her schedule, mostly to do with her work. She felt really conflicted about her work because her work made her work these, you know, so many long hours and, you know, working on Sunday and working on, you know, really limited her from being to meet with other Christians and really growing in her spiritual walk. But also she worked at this, you know, where she worked was with kids that had been taken away from their parents due to neglect or abuse. And so she felt like needed there in a sense. So she was really conflicted. So this went on for about a year and a half, having this job where she felt like she wasn't sure if she should leave or stay or what she should do. Finally, she made up her mind she was going just to quit her job. So she, without looking for another job with a replacement, she just quit her job and said, you know what? I'm going to put this in God's hands. And some of us might call that reckless. Some of us might call that faithful. But let me just tell you what happened next so we don't have to call it. 2 weeks later, she got the perfect job. where now she's working regular hours. She's able to meet with the Christians since then. I think actually today we announced it official that she's become part of the group, you know, to join the members there. And she's a tremendous blessing to us. So that's another encouraging story about what happens when we put the Lord first. I believe that's everyone. Okay, Peterson. Peterson's the man. I talked to you about that. You know, he's one of my best friends. The picture there to the left is the first public prayer he led after he joined the church, and that's kind of a special picture, memory for me. A lot of Emmanuel's friends that was converted around the time that he was, they've since left the faith, but Peterson is remaining true. And I feel for him sometimes, because I wonder if he looks around and realizes that all these guys that were Christians right when I became a Christian, they're not here anymore. But Peterson's there. Peterson's enduring through this. And so Peterson's probably my best friend up in Boston, or one of my best friends, and he's probably the biggest encouragement to me. During the summer, he got kicked out of his parents' house, basically. His dad decided he didn't want the financial responsibility of keeping Peterson. And so Peterson, at that point, was really interested in going to this guy's Bible camp. It's called the Sons of Light Camp, very similar to the men's camp that some of the guys here have gone to in the past or do go to, where it's basically a week long of this Bible study every day. And Peterson just thought that would be the most amazing thing. So he wanted to go so bad. So shortly after he got kicked out of his folks' place, he didn't have a place to stay, and the caseworker said, "Hey, I have a place for you to stay. It's like this really nice shelter to stay at, but you can't leave. Like, you can't go on vacation because they'll give your bed to someone else." And before I even offered for him to stay with me, he said he would prefer to be homeless for a month so that he could go and learn about the Bible with these other guys, you know, and to learn from that. There are certain ways where he doesn't know a whole lot about Scripture. He's still learning, and he's growing a lot every day. But he gets it, doesn't he? I think we can look at him, and we see, yeah, I might know more than Peterson, but I'm not sure I have as much faith as Peterson. And so we can all grow from one another. This is an example of that. So these are just some of the people that I'd like you to pray for and be thoughtful of, and to know that these sorts of things are happening. Now, like I mentioned with Peterson's, you know, friends and people that I've, you know, talked about in previous reports, it's not all a fairy tale, you have the biggest highs when you're working with people with souls, but you also have the deepest lows. In 3 John, John said that, "I have no greater joy than to hear that my children are walking in truth." And I think that's true, but I also believe it to be true, I think, that wouldn't that mean that there is no greater grief or sorrow than to hearing that your children are walking from the truth? And I feel like I've sensed a little bit of that that grief through the bad decisions that we make. So it's not all, I never want to give the impression that this is some faraway land or this is some make-believe area. There are tough times, but there are also, you know, heroes, and then there are, God's doing good things in Boston, as he is in all areas of his kingdom. If there's anything that we can help you with, you know, the church here, just doing prayers or encouragement, if there's anything that we can help you understand or any desire that you have, this would be a great time to make that known to the congregation and to the elders here. So if you wouldn't mind, and if you have needs, please come forward as we stand and sing.
Yeah.